Okay, here we are back with Act Two.
I'm going to introduce my compadre, who will introduce our next poet. Whether you're ready or not, I give you Jason Sommer.
I will be brief, because the guy who was supposed to do the introductions for Alan Shapiro punked out at the last minute, so I'm doing it now. This will lower your expectations. Alan Shapiro is, I will admit to you that I have introduced people before, and I have lied gracefully about my sense of their abilities and talent. You will have to trust me this time that I am telling the truth. I feel confident that I'm introducing a major American poet to you. He's a poet I turn to again and again when I want the poetry that I look for, the poetry that saves my life in some way. I also will admit to a personal connection with Alan Shapiro. He's been an integral part of two of the proudest moments of my career. He helped me with my long poem, Mengele Shitting, the elegant title. And he is the cause of me being barred from Keogh's pub in Ireland for fighting, something I am inordinately proud of, though he threw the punch. I'm available to tell that story at any time. It involves someone thinking he was a righty when he was a lefty, and it was a fatal mistake. He's the author of 8 terrific books of poetry. Again, I return to them again and again and again. Most recently, and the one he'll honor us with several selections from, I hope, is Tantalus in Love. He's won the Kingsley Tufts Award for the book before last, The Dead, Alive, and Busy. He's also won the Los Angeles Times Prize for Poetry, an Academy of Arts and Letters Award in Literature, and many other honors, the most ironic of which is the best poetry. I forget what the, no, it's for the best poet by the best poetry by a North Carolinian. By no stretch of the imagination, except for address, can this man be considered a North Carolinian. That was for Song and Dance. He's the William R. Keenan Distinguished Professor of English and Creative Writing at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. And he writes poetry that seems to me about, you know, that the famous Kazantzakis line, you know, where Zorba's asked, you know, are you married? And he says, wife, children, the full catastrophe. Alan writes about the full catastrophe. The poems not only are arresting for what they do with language and the utter depth of craft, but they are about things that matter. They are here because they are urgently necessary. And you feel that all the time that you read them. That these are poems that the poet and the reader can't do without. They're not games. They're written about the things of life that matter to all of us, that are indispensable and non-negotiable. I want to read just one thing by Brian Henry that I think gets at something about Alan's work. It's an essay about, a review essay about Song and Dance, where Henry talks about Alan's revival, reinvestment in the idea of a confessional mode. And he says, the propulsive long sentence contribute to the urgency girding the poet's voice, a voice that embraces humor but is too ravaged by grief to embody humor itself. Shapiro's seriousness is not solemnity. The poems in this book do not allow for high-mindedness or convenient emotion, and his grief is not melodrama. With its masterful handling of emotions, style, and subject matter, Song and Dance creates an enduring document of one man's death and his brother's response to it. jolting the confessional mode out of its complacency and setting a new standard in the process. And I just think that's true. And I think these poems are true poems, urgent and necessary poems. Alan Shapiro.
Oh, just want to thank Catherine for her reading, which was just terrific, and her comment about that Frank and I were looked at each other when she read it, about that in poetry nothing is quick and everything is perishable, made me think of a comment that Truman Capote made to a friend of his who was a fellow writer who had depreciated underplayed the pleasure he gotten in some kind of positive review somewhere, and Truman Capote said, don't turn your nose up at pleasures like that. It's a long walk between drinks. I think is a great line. Since we're in a restaurant, bar restaurant, I'm going to begin by reading a poem that's set in a restaurant. 30 some odd years ago, I was in a restaurant and overheard a couple having a marital spat. And the wife said something to the husband, a wonderful line that I wanted to get into a poem and had tried out in different ways and just never quite worked and finally found a way to do it. And it was a Chinese restaurant, and the poem is called Egg Rolls. And since it is a poem about that's set in a Chinese restaurant, you'll be hungry for another poem shortly after you hear this one. Anyway, it's called Egg Rolls. The gregarious babble muffled the sharp words the couple in the next booth were trying all through dinner not to have. Only an occasional, "No, you listened for a change," or "How dare you," or "I can't believe this," would rise above the barely suppressed staccato, "Please God, not now, not here," rhythm of an argument they wanted both to swallow and spit out. Then the pause, the momentary silence in which the whole place seemed to be listening to the woman say it last, clearly and slowly, so everyone could hear. "It's not the egg rolls, Harry. It's the last 10 years. Oh, Harry. Can you forgive them? The young couple in the next booth who laughed out loud but really did try not to. Surely you heard them. How could you not have, as you ran past, hurrying after her, your disappearing wife? And though it's nearly 30 years since then, would it console you now to learn they didn't last a year, that couple? And even that night, although they strolled home hand in hand, a little less estranged for all the laughter you occasioned, even after making love and meaning it and lying back, no part of either of them touching now, they heard, they couldn't help but lie there wide awake and hear the couple from the next apartment, who for all they knew could have been you and her, go at it longer, louder, deeper into the night than they themselves had ever thought was possible. A poem, I don't think it needs really any explanation. It's called Dog and Owner. It's about not so much about the war in Iraq or about those photographs of the Abu Ghraib prison, but about the effect of looking at those photographs. And the easy outrage they provoked. The poem is called Dog and Owner, and it's in two parts. Part one, Dog and Owner. What's obvious is what surprises, that the naked man made to look like a dog with dog collar and leash looks more like a dog than a man caught in a sex game or threatened with lynching or dragged like meat across the floor. A dog who's just now rolled in something, something which so engrosses him that for the moment of the picture, he doesn't realize he's been yanked back What? That's what his look says. And the soldier who holds the leash as if she were the owner of the dog looks like the owner of a dog. Her casual t-shirt tucked into fatigues, tucked neatly into boots. Dog owner on a morning stroll. This morning, a bit distracted, thinking maybe about the day ahead or last night, what she should have done or did, and so fails to notice what the dog is doing till it's too late, and she has to jerk the leash hard to pull him back, letting his lead go slack. The moment of the picture when you almost hear her saying, stern but not unkindly, come on now, boy, let's go. The fun is over. Two. The mind strains to sniff the delicious stink of outrage, stink of pleasure, of not suffering that, of doing that, of being done to that way. Irresistible stink of the mind that the mind strains not to nuzzle into, roll on, lap up, the taut leash jerking it harder and harder. What? A year before I went to Ireland to live with Jason and Bernadine, somebody, I guess they don't know to this day whether it was the IRA or the British or the Protestants who set the bomb off in Dublin, but there was a bomb went off in Dublin, and according to people that I talked to, it was close to Trinity, not right, Bernadine, and it blew the windows out of the library. And when I went to Dublin a year later, I spent a lot of time in Trinity Library, and I went there to read poetry and study poetry. And I mean, I wasn't a student; I was just doing it on my own. And it was during this time that I read a lot of Renaissance poetry, and particularly Thomas Wyatt. And so this is a poem about it's provoked by current events and remembering, you know, reading poetry in Trinity Library, reading those wonderful 16th century poems, particularly poems like, you know, "They flee from me that sometime did me seek," which is glossed in the poem. It has a line, a wonderful seduction scene in which the man is remembering, the speaker is remembering the moment of lovemaking with this woman, and her gown falls from her shoulder, and she me caught in her arms long and small, and therewith sweetly did me kiss and softly ask, "Dear heart, how like you this?" And so that phrase comes in the poem. And the poem is really about the place of poetry in a time of war. And the poem's called Old War. Where is the bower? Inside what book? Beside which window? In an ancient city I went to more than 30 years ago. Where is the bower, the bright mesh made from the names of flowers I, beyond the page, could not identify? Where is the bower, the loosened tress, the laugh, the eager rustle of the hand that slips the thin strap from the willing dress, and as it falls, the "dear heart, how like you this?" plain courtesy of wanting what is wanted when it is. And when the bomb exploded and the window shattered in a silver shower as oddly pretty as any in the bower, a silver shower showering red over the words that told how birdsong answered birdsong everywhere overhead, and everyone who could was running while the bloody page went fluttering out into the city where the old war raged, where was the bower, and where is it now, and how do I get back to where the dress is falling, but not yet on the ground? I'm going to read just a couple of another new poem, and then I'll read from this new book, Tantalus in Love. I'm 53 years old, and find myself writing. I feel new to my 50s, so it's a fresh experience. And particularly when you fall in love when you're 50 and your wife is, roughly your own age, as she should be. There's a lot of overlapping histories, and it makes for some interesting encounters, and I'll be reading a couple of poems, more than one poem, about that experience. This first poem about that, and it's a new one, it's called The 50s Dance, and it's, of course, both that we're dancing to 50s music, but also everybody at the dance is in their 50s. And it's pretty, beyond that, it's pretty self-explanatory. So it's called The 50s Dance. We're dancing near the stage when she notices me noticing her staring at the lead singer. She smiles and says, "He looks like Jay, the ex-lover, Clint Eastwood twin." Her tone so casual, I can't help think it isn't. So I say, "You mean the Barry Manilow look-alike?" And she says, "Yeah, right." Meaning, "Whatever you say, dear." As her eye takes in again the tall physique, the loose blouse and pajama bottoms, the rugged face, more rugged somehow for the graying ponytail, and soft voice, soft but clear but ardent, singing, "Wandering in the daylight, searching for you with a flashlight." I pull her close. I ask, "But seriously, if he'd been more available, you'd have stayed with that guy, right?" And she says, "You mean if he'd been a different person?" Spinning away till I draw her back to ask what comes out as a statement. "But if not for that, he'd have been your ideal man," meaning in bed, his body. And she says, smiling, patting my cheek, "No, honey, I married you, didn't I? You're the sexiest man I've ever been with." It's not funny. The compliment itself, a complicated dance of irony and affection, doo-wop of late passion, as is the thumbs up I smiling offer in return, and the laugh we laugh then, grateful and edgy, too knowing not to be, yet fresher for what it knows, and stranger too. And as we dance, I lip-sync to the singer who I am and am not mocking now, my head thrown back like his, my eyes like his, half-closed, better to see in daylight with a flashlight how her eyes could fix on mine, on me, unable ever to tear themselves away. There goes my glasses. Those are some new poems. This book, Tantalus in Love, is a book of, really, the book of love poems, and both the end of a marriage and the start of a new relationship. I'll read something on the same theme that I just read. This one's called Iris, and it's inspired by a photograph, beautiful photograph by a friend of mine, Frank Hunter, photographer, and it's of an iris, and there's a beautiful lavish blossom at the top, and then along the stalk are all these older blossoms that are kind of withered and falling off, and I just juxtaposed that image next to this incident where, you know, the speaker and his wife are looking through old photograph album, and a picture falls out of the sleeve of her with her ex-husband, and again, these sort of colliding histories. The poem's called Iris. Love flower of the middle-aged, the inter-animating pain and beauty in the way the stalk bends under the unexpected weight of the still uncrumpling, gaudy tissue of the newest blossom, while the lower blossoms, like a ghostly time-lapse in reverse, appear to shrivel into themselves and turn away forlorn before they fall, the way the snapshot fell from its sleeve into her lap, and there she was, my new love with her old love years before, beside a lake with blue hills in the distance rolling down to bluer water, and there they were, the lovers, naked, hand in hand, both smiling back at me a smile of joy so new, so mischievous, you couldn't look at it and not believe no lovers ever gave themselves so freely to each other. The flower bends under the blossom's weight. It trembles, bending. It almost seems to hold it up, as if to hold it there forever. It's one and only darling, honey child. How did I ever live without you? How could I ever let you go? I don't know poetry reading is complete without a poem about phone sex. So this one is called Premonition, and it's about phone sex. I don't know what else is there to say. Phone sex, premonition. Two lovers talking on the phone at night, ear pressed to the receiver, pressed to ear, for the half-whispering voices that are clearer for being quiet, more intimate somehow for being far away. The timber, pitch, and exact inflection of who they are in saying what they want, what they would do if they were there together, has never been so audible, as if the sheer voice stripped of body were revealing something about the nature of their love, not just for bodies, but of his body for hers and hers for his. The lovers never more exactly there, though less material, never more held, more truly clung to than in separation. I wish I could take you in my mouth right now. I wish your lips were here. The voice is hungry, ghost-like, and won't it be like this one day? Only the voice returning to the stark bed, voice rising up from where nobody rises, your voice or mine, to haunt us as tonight our voices haunt the hand that moves like the lips that speak the words of what the lips would do. I want to read a poem in which my old friend Tim Deacon and Jason's friend, buddy of ours from Stanford, wonderful. Catherine's essay, in a way, I mean, could have been written with him in mind. He was just an absolutely wonderful poet whose first book didn't come out till about 6 months after he died. And he was an alcoholic and died of pulmonary fibrosis. His book is called, it's published by Triquarterly Books, and it's called Another Day on Earth, and most of the book was written in the last 6 months of his life, even though he'd spent his whole life writing. But there was something about his impending death that really just kind of brought his work to another level. Just for Tim's sake, there's a in the book there's this wonderful sequence of poems called Occasional Uncles, about that sort of sequence about his divorce and becoming like an occasional uncle to his child, whom he only saw on weekends. And one of the poems is called in that sequence is called Sunday Visiting Day. The poem goes like this. This is Tim's poem, and it's addressed to the 2-year-old child. Your room's no different, but some toys are new. We kiss. I wonder who gave them to you, but don't ask. You're almost talking now, something I can't quite get about a cow, a secret conversation you and she share laughing while I eavesdrop bitterly. I hug you, gorging myself on the taste, touch, smell of you who shrug me off in haste to play again. You've seen the bright red car your friend is holding, playing in the yard. Your clear voice breaking into tears, you run, shouting, mine, mine, mine. Like father, like son. I've been offered on more than one occasion today since I've arrived here a shot of whiskey, and which I can't drink anymore. And so this is a poem in which Tim appears, and it's called On Having to Stop Drinking. The way it feels, there on the verge of the first sip of the day's first drink, the feeling that the moment this time could be held, prolonged, untouched by both the itchy late-day yearning for that first sip and the second sip's already too much, too late, too far gone fuck-itness. The way the shot glass, gold up to the rim, continues brimming, even as from lip to tongue to throat, well-being burns its golder promise of a life so dense with possibility that possibility's itself achievement. The first sip, both the work and the reward for work, both the performance and applause. The way now, on the anniversary of Tim's death, I see him on the night we met, holding that shot glass up and saying, "This boy, when you die and go to heaven, and God comes up to you and puts his arm around you and says, 'Welcome home, son,' this, you're going to smell this on his breath." He was a funny man. He used to say, talk about, again, go back to Catherine's reading. I have this friend of mine at North Carolina who's a violinist, and there's a joke that musicians tell about, there are three stages of a musician's career. The first stage is, who is Richard Luby? The second stage is, get me Richard Luby. Actually, four stages. The first stage is, who is Richard Luby? The second stage is, get me Richard Luby. The third stage is, get me a young Richard Luby. And the fourth stage is, who is Richard Luby? So I told this joke to Tim, actually, when he came down to Chapel Hill a couple months before he died to work on the poems that ended up in his book. I told him this joke, and he said, "You know, I seem to have gone from stage one to stage four without ever having passed through stages two and three." So anyway, in the late 50s, the Soviets sent a dog up into space called Laika. This was a border collie, and they raised the dog and pampered it and loved it and fed it, and then they put her into a rocket ship and sent it out of the universe with no intention of ever bringing it back. The purpose of the experiment was just to see how long a dog would live before it died in outer space. And I can remember hearing about this when I was a kid and seeing pictures of it and cartoons of it and all that. And it wasn't until I had children of my own that I realized it's a perfect metaphor for raising children. So this is called Space Dog, and it begins with a 13-year-old boy looking at himself in the mirror, it's called Space Dog. As if amazed, it's his. He holds his hand up before the mirror, hand too big now for the boy's body, hand he's turning slowly front to back to front, then closes to a fist he just as slowly opens like an exotic flower to its full extent. The boy, so newly merged with the emerging man, it's hard to say what's boy or man, but for the eyes, the boyish, rapt confusion in the look he looks with at his mobile features as he draws a blunt finger over the shadow of hair along his upper lip. Shadow of hair in armpit, crotch, voice deeper than it was, then higher, deeper, while the eyes, astounded, furtive, are the eyes of someone who cannot quite wake up from the dream in which he suddenly discovers he is naked among a crowd of strangers. Or like the eyes of Laika, Soviet space dog in an old drawing I remember, the stunned, not yet distrusting, but no longer trusting look from within the comical glass bubble of the gawky helmet tilted atop the comical white spacesuit as the spaceship hurtles out toward the stars, the Earth a star behind it, the earnest dog eyes fixed on black space like a door the masters have walked through and will return from surely. Surely they'll come to get me. Surely they didn't love me all that time for this. And I'm going to read one more poem. Actually, two more poems. Two more poems, and then stop. One short, one long. I think the hardest thing, my opinion and my experience, the hardest thing for kids from a broken home is not the recollection of discord between their parents, but the recollection of moments of harmony between them. That has to be a more troubling memory, since it didn't hold the couple together. This poem is called The Haunting, and it's addressed to the wife, and them in the poem are the children. The Haunting. It may not be may not be the ghostly ballet of our avoidances that they'll remember, nor the long sulks of those last months, nor the voices chilly with all the anger we were careful mostly not to show in front of them, nor anything at all that made our choice to live apart seem to us both not only unavoidable, but good, but just. No, what I think will haunt them is precisely what we've chosen to forget, those too infrequent, though even toward the end still possible moments when the children upstairs, the dinner cooking, one of us would all at once start humming an old tune, and we'd dance as if we did so always, in a swoon of gliding all through the house, across the kitchen, down the hall and back, we'd sway together, we'd twirl, we'd dip and cha-cha, and the children would hear us and be helpless not to come running down to burrow in between us, into the center of the dance, that now I think will haunt them for the very joy itself, for joy that was for them, for all of us together, something better than joy. And yet for you and me, ourselves, alone, apart, still not enough. And now the last poem is called Anger, and it's a little bit longer than the others. The situation is a strange couple. Husband is waking up in the early morning before his wife does, and looking at her sleeping and thinking about how she normally gets up before him to do yoga in the bedroom. And the animals that are referred to in the poem are yoga poses. So I think that's all you need to know. The poem's called Anger, and this will be the last poem I read. One morning, toward the end of 20 years of marriage, he awakens before she does and watches her beside him, her back to him, the covers pulled up tight and clutched in both hands, her eyes tense, everything about her stiffened, even in dream, against him, sealed away. Unusual for him to wake before her. Most mornings he's lulled from sleep in the half-dark by the low, murmuring rivulet of words the yoga teacher on the video is speaking, and by the music that isn't music so much as birdsong on the verge of music, or music, birdsong, some dreamy confluence of one into the other. And she is there in the TV's soft light at the foot of the bed, in pajama bottoms and a skimpy tank top, her lovely body that he hasn't touched in how long now? 5 months maybe, longer? The body he knows he'll never touch again, right there before him, there to be looked at without her knowing, being moved, it seems, yes, carried, drifted from pose to pose by the whispery currents of the teacher's urging, the warrior, the dog, the dolphin, and then the two he always waits for, the cobra that has her hips flat on the floor, arms pushing up slowly, straightening while the back arches, keeps arching till the breasts push out against the tank top and the nipples show, and then the one the cobra mutates into, hands reaching back behind her, holding her feet and pulling her body up into the bow he almost thinks invisible hands are holding, the expert fingers pulling the string back farther, the unseen arrow poised, aimed, ready to fly. Something in the undeniable failure of who they are and have become together allows him now, this morning, here at least, if nowhere else, to think of what he did or might have done to drive her off. Oh, he knows he has his reasons for his anger. He is never at a loss for reasons for his anger. His sister's death, and then his brother's. And he, the youngest child, the baby, the last one you'd expect to carry out the task as in an old tale, suddenly become the good brother, the steadfast brother, there by the bedside, right through their illness to their final breath. The care itself, the opposite of skill. The kind of thing you do less well the more you do it. And while he did it, needing her, his wife, to somehow make it better, make it all right. Somebody, for God's sake, please take care of the caretaker. In the midst of these calamities, how often would he tell himself all bets are off? This is his time to slam doors and belittle and still be loved, never to have to bother with her terrors, her needs. His time for once, just his alone. How could she stand it, really? What did she feel, seeing him each day make his airtight case against the world, proving again, all through his brother's dying, what he had proved in no uncertain terms throughout his sister's, that there was never enough that anyone could do for him, especially his wife? Hadn't he proved this so he could hate her for it? One night, not long ago, the children asleep, they got to arguing over something. He can't remember what. She was trying to explain something to him, defend herself against some accusation in his tone, which he denied was there and she insisted she heard, when all at once he stood and grabbed a chair and slammed it down and shattered it to pieces. She was terrified, and he apologized, then wanted to make love. It had been so long. And she said, "How can I touch you when you're like this?" And he snapped back, "Well, maybe if you did touch me, I wouldn't be like this." Sometimes he almost thinks he's willed these losses, wooed them, that they were sent to him as answered prayers. No selfishness, no self-absorption, no amount of treachery could ever sate his appetite to be betrayed, neglected, shunted aside, so he could feel himself the righteously aggrieved, abandoned husband. Wouldn't it be beyond his wildest dreams if she were really having an affair, as he accused her of having almost daily? Who is it? Just tell me who it is. Is it the yoga teacher? The chiropractor? Who? How could she stand it except by pulling back in self-protection, and in doing so play right into his hands and make him feel so innocent, so noble, so deserving? One night, a few weeks back, their anger spent, exhausted into a rare intimacy, an almost elegiac closeness, as if they were remembering themselves like this, being a couple, lovers, talking in bed. She was telling him about this vision she'd had while doing yoga, of this white light, this warm, miraculous white light that filled her with inexplicable well-being. The vision was all her own, it seemed, and no one's, deep within the self, and yet completely separate. A vision, she said, of being beyond the self, even beyond life, imperturbable, immovable, eternal, perfect and whole. He notices how tightly his own hands now are twisted in the sheets. He unshackles them. As he slips from the bed, she stretches out, relaxing now into untroubled sleep. At the foot of the bed, he sees her yoga mat, a darker shadow in the dark room. And beyond the mat, he sees the dormer window, where a few stars still quiver in the black sky. Those stars will have already disappeared, fading as the dawn sky brightens when she herself lies down on the mat on her stomach, her back arching so slowly up into the cobra that it will look as if it's being formed not by the pushing of her arms, but by some higher power drawing her up. That power will hold her in that pose a moment, neck thrown back, her lovely neck, her face looking straight up at the ceiling before it eases her back down, and with her forehead on the floor, knees bent, hands behind her, gripping her feet, it gently pulls her up into the bow. What is it like to be held that way, to hold yourself so poised, so still, as if you could be all one thing, complete, enclosed? Didn't someone say somewhere that everything can be divided into smaller and smaller pieces, that there is no end to division, that infinity extends down into the infinitely small as well as up to the infinitely large? So if you shot an arrow, it would never reach its target, since the distance could be halved and halved and halved ad infinitum. He stands on the mat, slowly, as if it were a pose that she herself might do, as if he too were being moved by something. He turns sideways toward the window, his gaze fixed on a single star whose faint light makes the black sky all around it even blacker. He raises his arms until his right's extended straight out toward the star, his left bent at the elbow, two fingers pulling the string back farther and farther, aiming into the darkness till he lets it go. Thank you very much for listening.